Hi everyone, I'm Josh, and this is The Emerald, Currents and Trends Through a Mythic Lens, the podcast where we explore an ever-changing world and our lives in it through the lens of myth, story, and imagination. The Emerald, all that's happening on this green jewel in space. So, earth-shaking news this week coming to us out of Ireland. I'm speaking, of course, of the Irish Supreme Court's ruling that Subway, the sandwich fast food chain, can't claim that their bread is actually, well, bread. First off, what I wouldn't give to live in a country where these are the decisions that are coming before the Supreme Court. How very wholesome it all seems. But yeah, apparently in Ireland there are rules about what constitutes bread. According to NPR, the Irish Value-Added Tax Act of 1972 says, in order to be officially considered bread, your bread can't have sugar, fat, and bread improver exceed 2% of the weight of flour. Bread improver. We'll come back to that. In his book, In Defense of Food, Michael Pollan takes us on a journey into bread. You see, bread used to be one of those things that was extremely simple. Flour, water, yeast, and perhaps a pinch of salt. Then, of course, we decided that bread should be essentialized, stripped of all that messy, husky, fibrous wondrousness, in favor of bread that was uniformly white, soft, and pillowy. No gritty texture to it, and of course, very sweet. Just take bread out of its former context. What could go wrong? Only problem was, bread lost all its nutritional value. It became basically fluffy cardboard. So then we had to inject a whole bunch of stuff back into it to make it nutritious again. Emulsifiers, lecithins, guar gum, something named azotocarbonamide, ethoxylated monoglycerides, high fructose corn syrup. So yeah, the extraction of the perceived essence of things and the destruction of context in the process, only to later discover that, guess what, the context was actually important, is another way of describing the history of the modern world. We can call it the Wonder Bread cycle. We can see the ripples of this cycle everywhere. We see it in the movement of spiritual traditions to the West, in which the embodied animist roots are discarded in favor of the philosophies that are focused on a higher essence, a white, pillowy, soft, sweet oneness. We see it in mindfulness practices that are wrenched from their somatic flesh and husk. We see it in psychedelic therapies that remove spiritual, communal, and ritual context in favor of simply administering isolated compounds. We see it really in the entire trajectory of Western philosophy, in which empty ruminations about how things might be are not anchored with actual life practice. And we certainly see it in Western science, which is right at the heart of why we rip things from context to begin with. Ultimately, all this decontextualization takes place within a larger context. In a world that is relentlessly geared towards monetization, demolishing context becomes a necessity. You could say it's its own context. And we're left with a world that must constantly destroy itself to survive, stripping away layers because, why? The thing in and of itself, whatever it is, a mountain, a loaf of bread, a system of ritual, is never enough as it is. If it's going to be properly monetized, it has to be torn apart. While all the time, of course, ultimately, the messy, husky, fibrous wondrousness is what makes life good and keeps bread and minds simple and whole. When bread is no longer bread, the importance of context in consciousness, community, and cosmos. Today on The Emerald. Safe to say that we live in a postmodern world in which the modern mind lives in a demolition heap of context. Poet William Wordsworth put it this way, quote, Our meddling intellect misshapes the beauteous forms of things. We murder to dissect. End quote. This murderous dissection stems from a fundamental choice that certain societies made along the way. The decision that the best way to understand the world, or at least the best way to extract things from it, is to remove things from their natural context in order to study them as isolated bits. This study of things as isolated bits, the central drive of modern science, itself does not happen in a vacuum. It occurs within a matrix of progress narratives and assumptions about human purpose. In other words, why do we want to isolate bits and study them? This drive isn't neutral. It's set within a larger value system that is so inherent to the modern world that it's like water. If we're fish, we don't even notice it. That's another way of saying that we would be spending a whole lot less time isolating and dissecting if it weren't essential to making money and growing economies. The disregarding of place, for example, sourcing water from faraway Fiji when we could get it right here for free, is a deliberate smashing of context because monetization depends on it. The ceaseless river of product offerings demands that we remove things from context. For how else can we sell them? How do you sell the lifelong journey of a Siberian shaman? How do you sell yoga when yoga is ultimately a state of being? How do you sell a yoga teacher training when traditionally that training was a 30 or 40 year proposition? How do you sell water when it bubbles right up out of the earth? How? You remove these things from context. The implications of the loss of context can be seen and felt in a world in which a massive percentage of children can't name five plants that are native to their own backyard. You can see this loss of context everywhere. You can see it sliding down ski slopes in burqas at Ski Dubai, a 66,000 square foot artificial ski slope that uses 8,500 gallons of water a day in the middle of the driest desert region on the planet. It seeps its way into wounded minds who are radicalized by ideas and symbols that have no connection to their actual lived experience. Like, I'm going to hate ideas and people that I've only heard about on the internet. It pervades social media yelling matches when we argue with digital icons representing people we've never met. It makes increasing numbers of people unable to discern fact from fiction. In fact, increasing numbers of people don't really seem to be able to drive anymore. Anyone else notice this? It's getting pretty wonky out there on the roads. This loss of context settles over Manhattan in a thick layer of light pollution that prevents people from seeing the stars, stars which traditionally provided context. In the postmodern fog, how many do not know where the sun will set in the evening or rise in the morning? How many know how to find the pole star at night? How many know what phase the moon is in right now? How many can instinctively point east without thinking about it? Or can picture in their minds now the shape of the web of rivulets and streams that forms their local watershed, where these streams originate, what valleys they drain, and where they run. We gladly sacrifice context for the privilege of eating tropical summer fruit in the dead of winter in the Northeast United States. Our young sacrifice context for the unrelenting maelstrom of TikTok, bombarded by a deluge of chattering faces and airbrushed digital bunny ears and googly eyes, digesting crass memes and images of the sacred and motivational quotes and daily outrages equally. How does the mind make of this anything resembling context? How does one see the ocean for the waves? We've become pretty good at identifying this loss of context in the environment, bemoaning the loss of place and celebrating local foods. We're less prone to recognizing it in our own minds, but the mind thrives in context. The mythic traditions of the world, which means, in essence, traditions that apply to everyone, everywhere, for a very long time, the mythic traditions of the world set the human being in a living, breathing, dynamic context that extends across individual consciousness to community and cosmos. The mythic mind is populated. Its vast spaces reinforced with the songs and stories of seers and travelers, and clever women and crones, and intrepid youngest daughters, and bards who made the leaves shake and the stones skip, and heroes whose sword strokes set hidden waters flowing. The mythic mind is populated in order to forge a mind in which consciousness and sentient landscape and community and morality and ritual and artistic expression are ultimately seamless. There is an architecture to the mythic mind, and the mind itself is architected on an ongoing basis. Ritual architects the mind. Visioning practices, so present in the tantric traditions, architect the mind. The contextual mind is jewel-like, they say, or grove-like, or like a lake, say the bhakti texts, where a swan eternally sports in the illuminated water. If you want to see a profound vision of contextual mind, look at the 11th century wall paintings at Alchi Monastery in Ladakh, the most intricate mandalas you've ever seen. I visited the Five Elemental Buddha room and the paint was leaping off the walls. The mandala is the structured consciousness in its blazing glory. It is context, aflame. Context, shining. Context, reverberating with life. The Kubjika Mata Tantra offers a mandala, a geometric architectural visioning of the contextual mind that has at its very center the village goddess tree. It extends outwards through a wheel of matrikas, directional mother goddess energies intimately tied to land, to east, west, north, and south, to river and stream, which then expresses into manifestations of the goddess that are synonymous with vocations. The camphor seller, the collyrium girl, the cobbler, then extends into a subcontinental geography of India itself, and ultimately reveals itself to be a map of both the mind and of all of creation. So in this vision, mind, community, and creation are one thing. The Aboriginal mind was continuous with the humming web of song lines that permeated inner and outer geography. Landscape is song, is story, is context. The universe itself becomes a moral mirror. The Milky Way is a glowing band of universal laws. Everything reinforces who we are. The stories of the heroes shout back at us from the stones. A culture that loses this anchoring in time and space and place and law and love and life, says Tyson Yonkaporta, might find itself asking a whole lot of adolescent questions. What am I doing here? What's my purpose in life? Untethered minds, adrift, trying to graze sheep in places sheep should never be grazed, when ultimately purpose is the song that's always being sung back to us. So back to Michael Pollan. I love his books. It's interesting, though, because Pollan seems more concerned about context when it comes to food than when it comes to the human brain. His recent book on psychedelics, How to Change Your Mind, is wonderful, but it's also interesting how quickly it embraces the new Western medical therapeutic use of psychedelics, which is pretty much the neurobiological equivalent of processed food, extracting essence and discarding traditional context. What do I mean by that? Well, first of all, I know that a lot of people have been helped through psychedelic therapy. I even know some of them. And that's important. I'm not advocating against it. I'd rather you go to a therapist-moderated psilocybin session than, say, drop acid and run naked through Columbia Township Park before ending up in police custody and asking to have your penis cut off, like one Florida man did. Good old Florida man. So, yeah, there is more context inherent in psychedelic therapy than in randomly tripping and running about. Psychedelics have a lot to offer a mental health field dominated by antidepressants. But this is also worth exploring a little deeper in relation to context. in relation to this Wonder Bread cycle of decontextualization and monetization. Enter Viridia, a for-profit subsidiary of Atai Life Sciences, a biotech company that's looking at psychedelic solutions for mental health issues. Viridia is working with ayahuasca, the visionary entheogenic sacrament of the Amazon basin. The company, quote, aims to develop new formulations of the brew's active ingredient N,N-dimethyltryptamine, or DMT, to use alongside talk therapy to treat a variety of mental health disorders. The idea is to take advantage of the neuroplasticity brought about by a psychedelic experience to help patients overcome ailments such as depression. Atai will also pair its DMT products with a digital therapeutic, which can help doctors monitor patients remotely and tailor treatment to each patient. So we'll leave digital therapeutics and the labeling of DMT as a product aside for a moment, and just say that there are many things about this that sound positive, right? Treatment-resistant depression finally being treated successfully. People with PTSD finally getting some relief. And so I don't want to sound negative here. I'll say that within the context of what we've got in the fragmented modern world, it's good that these options are being explored out there. But let's look a little deeper, too. Let's look at context. The context in which ayahuasca is traditionally taken in communities across Brazil, Bolivia, Peru, has certain commonalities. These commonalities extend to the use of peyote in the Huichol tradition, the use of mushrooms in Mexico, the use of amanita in Siberia. Entheogenic use across the board is ritual, communal, contextual, and ultimately spiritual. The matrix within which entheogenic use happens, traditionally, is spiritual. So, when science says, well, let's just isolate the compound, first of all, DMT, because, hey, it's fast-acting and that's more conducive to a talk therapy session than a 4 or 6 or 8 hour ayahuasca journey, and it's more controllable, less variables, etc. That's a decision right off the bat that's being made within the context of monetization. Faster is better. Hey, not everyone has time to establish deep relational context. Time is money. DMT is a product. But deep context happens to be important. There's a reason that all the entheogenic traditions, for example, use sacred songs. There's a reason that they call and invoke and placate certain forces that are harmonically associated with certain plants. There's a reason that animate beings of tree and cloud and water are sung to. There's a reason that there is a ritual progression that takes place that sets, you could say, the energetic table, providing context. It's not in any traditional context, here, take this and let me sit next to you with a notepad and listen to you talk for the next hour. But as usual, science attempts to extract what it perceives to be the essence, not just of the plant, but of the human experience. The human being in isolation is the subject removed from context, when of course, ultimately, the context is what allows the human mind to transform. Because when you say, for example, the songs aren't important, the animate beings invoked across all these traditions aren't important, the community isn't important, the larger relationship with the universe isn't important, what's ultimately important is your individual brain isolated in a room talking about itself. Well, that's a gross misunderstanding of how the mind actually works. The mind is a mandala of context. It sits in relation to the song, in relation to the ritual, in relation to the community, in relation to the cosmos, and is not complete without those things. And the establishment and ongoing reinforcement of this type of context is ultimately more important than any quick individual breakthrough that might happen. This is why the growing trend of weekend psychedelic getaways, which also, of course, are monetized, is a phenomenon that sits firmly within the Wonder Bread cycle we're talking about. Come, have a great life-shattering breakthrough experience this weekend without any of the necessary contextual considerations of communal integration, long-term practice, actual spiritual work in relationship. It'll change everything right away. It's selling the essence of a thing rather than the context in which it naturally lives and thrives. So, back to this little matter of the context of spirituality and sacredness in which all traditional entheogenic exploration happens. Science has a hard time with this part, of course. For all the lip service science is now paying to indigenous knowledge, ultimately, science is deeply uncomfortable with and, as a result, utterly disregards the whole spirit part of the equation, which is, of course, the main part. Science prefers to exist in a matrix of quantifiability which it deems is more neutral, which is interesting because science actually exists in a matrix of monetization and decontextualization, both of which are decidedly non-neutral. There's nothing more neutral about taking entheogens in a lab or a hospital as opposed to a forest. There's nothing neutral about charging a person through their insurance plan for entheogenic therapy sessions involving a product that is removed from all communal and ritual context. There's nothing neutral about paying for mental health. The natural matrix of plant medicine is the spiritual, not the monetary, which begs the question, would Viridia be doing any of this if they couldn't make a lot of money off of it? And the answer, of course, is no. And how does that dovetail, how does that intersect with constructing healthy minds in context? Let me put forth an idea here. Sacredness, sacrament, is a geometric relationship. It is context itself. Is sacrament still sacramental when removed from context? Take the living Kumari goddess out of the center of her mandala of context in Bhaktapur, Nepal, and throw her in the middle of Times Square, and is she still sacred? Sacredness is a relationship. So self in relation to universe in relation to the other is sacred. Jesus says this very thing. Love the other as oneself, and love God above all things. This is sacred geometry. This is a mandala of context. Mental health, in this vision, is healthy geometry, a healthy flow across individual, community, and cosmos. Minds that are too turned inward upon themselves can't benefit fully from this geometry. The geometry of a lot of the self-help movement and a lot of talk therapy models, and I know this is changing somewhat, but that geometry tends to be an inward spiral that's not reflective of an actual mandala of relational context. Like, sometimes the relationality with community, with ritual, with song, with children, with others, with the forest, with the starry sky, is what causes the context necessary for the issues to melt away. Context heals in a way that ongoing self-referential monologue may not. This is why sometimes it's interesting to see when what we call for in our social movements these days is basically a national equivalent of talk therapy. We've got to have a national conversation about X, we hear quite often. And yes, some issues certainly need to be brought directly into the light, though what the light is in relation to national conversation is another question. But other issues melt away when contexts are created which allow them to melt away. So the building of positive structures, of communal geometries, one could say, goes a long way towards addressing societal ills. But that's a big topic. Let's just say that in this vision, the path for each of us is a path of relationality that unfolds within context. This is why there is in the Buddhist tradition, for example, not simply the meditator on the cushion alone dealing with their issues. There is Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the awakened presence, the teachings, and the community. This forms a triangle of context that self-reinforces as each point of the triangle exists in reciprocal exchange with the other. I've mentioned in previous episodes that as a teenager I worked at a spiritual bookstore. At the same time, I was a devout Tibetan Buddhist and was attending teachings, studying Tibetan and Sanskrit languages, taking empowerments, and doing meditative practices. In the Tibetan tantric traditions, there is a deep context established around these practices. First, they require an empowerment, a ritual in which one is enabled by a teacher to do the practice. They require that foundational practices be done first before they're undertaken. basic architectures have to be built in the mind of the practitioner. Basic relationships need to be established. Protocols need to be honored. Then and only then does a practitioner start to do certain practices. Or that's how it was. Imagine my surprise when I started seeing books coming out in the early 90s, some from respected Buddhist masters, in which the highest, deepest, most secret teachings were handed out on a platter for 15 bucks a pop. Highest Yoga Tantra, which normally takes years upon years upon years of foundational practice before the practitioner is deemed ready. Across the Tibetan Buddhist world, this has become a major issue. Empowerments are doled out like collectible products. Secret teachings are available at cost. Highest Yoga Tantra sits right next to Chicken Soup for the Soul and Deepak Chopra's Metahuman on the shelf, and each is equal to the other in the decontextualized mind. There are reasons that this happened. For Tibetan Buddhism, a tradition that was ripped from its original context, forced into exile after Chinese invasion, monetization became a means of survival. And the issue here is not just about commercialism, for there's been a relationship with spirituality and monetary transaction for a very long time. It's a question of whether a mind that encounters profound teachings without any context can really do anything with those teachings at all. In the Grail myth, a young, foolish Parzival stumbles his way into the Grail King's domain, not knowing where he is or how he got there. Actually, he bargains his way in by trying to pawn off stolen goods as his own. Of course, he doesn't see the divine mysteries, doesn't know that where he sits is at the foot of the fount of everlasting life, doesn't grasp at the old fisherman before him as the Grail King, because it's not his to know. The Western individualist obsession with entitlement fits well in a decontextualized world. I get to have that because everything should be available to everyone all the time, right? This is a recipe for demolishing sacredness. For sacredness, again, is geometry. It's not a free-for-all. If the geometry is absent, if the vessel is leaky, then the water just pours through and lands, as Jesus says, on bare rock. Walking into a spiritual bookstore can be like Parzival unwittingly stumbling into the land of the Grail King, a fount of universal knowledge yet utterly unmeaningful as it does not exist within the context of community, practice, time, patience, slow unfolding, guidance, constructing, progressing step by step. This is another way of saying that there is a reason that quests in the myths happen in layers and levels. It's the same reason certain song protocols are set during entheogenic ceremonies. It's the same reason that ancient Greek theater builds towards catharsis slowly, and that Indian temples take you on a sequential journey towards the stone that sits at the center. The treasures of mind unveil themselves slowly and deliberately as we build structures that can accommodate them. These days, Tantra, and particularly Hindu Tantra, is a rising field of study and practice. Non-dual Kashmiri tantric teachings and their possibly world-affirming dynamism have a sparkly draw to them. It doesn't hurt that the figure at the center of the non-dual Shaiva Tantra universe, Abhinavagupta, was an absolute genius that has given us some of the most profound elucidations on consciousness ever written. Yet, Tantra, like many disciplines, has also been utterly ripped from context. Tibetan Tantra, taught within lineage by empowered teachers, still maintains a good deal of this context of clearly elucidated practices, sequential progression, ritual engagement, empowerment, transmission. Shaiva Tantra, in the West, on the other hand, is not being carried forward by lineage holders empowered to transmit practices. and so what remains bears very little resemblance to traditional Tantra. Tantra, as André Padou once wrote, is hyper-ritualism. Traditional Tantra involves such a deep and regular ritualized practice regimen, such specific protocols, such an emphasis on direct transmission, such an emphasis on lineage, such a deliberate architecting of mind through sonic tools and visualization and puja, that it is extremely difficult to see any correspondence between Tantra as it existed in its Indian context and the worldviews of the droves of yogis who now self-identify as tantric. Tantra in context almost certainly involved daily, regular, sustained interaction with the animate forces of place, with elaborate ritual designed around directional and local beings. It involved hours of recitation and mantric practice and architecting the mind stuff in highly specific ways and spirit placation and a dash of what we call magic. And that's not even getting into the left-handed stuff. Tantra was deeply, deeply contextualized. It was a tapestry, a loom, in fact, of context. And don't get me wrong, I love the tantric teachings. There's a lot of great work being done by a lot of great scholars who are illuminating the teachings of texts that are profoundly beautiful. But it's important to remember that texts are the essentialized husk of a spiritual path. They aren't the path itself. And the path, the living, dynamic, breathing path, the path that seeks to establish the individual in context, in relation, in a mandala of deliberately architected consciousness within community and cosmos, is not something that one can actualize theoretically through written words, not something that one transmits who doesn't have the power to transmit, not something that can exist free of context. Because again, sacredness is context. Remove the context, and it is like Kumari in Times Square. It's like Percival stumbling through the Grail King's domain, not knowing where he is, bargaining his way in with a stolen necklace. What remains is a worldview that can be alluded to, a ghost of an inkling, a philosophy of how things might be, and not a living, actualized thing. Which is fine, that's what we've got. But let's admit that's what we've got. Let's admit that as great as it is that Oxford scholars are illuminating 11th century thought for us, what is filtering through is so profoundly different than the actual practice of these traditions in context that everything related to the modern practice of Kashmiri Shaiva Tantra should be emblazoned with a massive asterisk. This is read material, not lived material. This is an idea, not yet an embodiment. Of course, contexts change, rituals evolve. I'm not suggesting that there is one static context that must be preserved as it is for all time. Buddhism, for example, became very Japanese in Japan, very Tibetan in Tibet. But what's different is that the defining cultural characteristic of those transformations was not decontextualization for the purpose of monetization. The Wonder Bread cycle. Rip it out of context and monetize it. This is the defining characteristic of modern Western adoption of spiritual tradition. And again, it's not neutral. It's worth asking, what gets kept and what gets lost? For example, if we recognize within the spiritual traditions the sequential progression that a practitioner must go through in order to finally throw back the curtains and experience the naked beholding of mind, the step-by-step ascension to the mysteries that literally all mystery schools recognize, and we know that progression traditionally happened through the slow and careful evaluation of the practitioner's state of being by experienced teachers, what happens when that process gets monetized? What happens when, hey, the more workshops you buy with me, the more I'll clue you in to the advanced teachings? This is a profound problem. In Tibetan Tantra, in fact, they'd call it the path to some pretty unsavory rebirths coming down the line. But this is only one of the ways in which decontextualization and monetization infuse the Western adoption of spiritual tradition. What gets thrown out, almost always, is the living, embodied, dynamic, actualized, structural, communal aspects of tradition. The postmodern mind discards the body of the practitioner, the body of the natural context in which the tradition sits, the body of animate beings that surround the practitioner, in favor of what it perceives to be philosophical essence, essence extraction, just like Wonder Bread. What do I mean? I mean, bluntly, that Hinduism and Buddhism are unapologetically animist, and that this animism is as important to the tradition as are the quote-unquote higher ruminations on the nature of consciousness. Yet the animate is always the first thing to go. The beings to be fed, the mandala of context in which the practice sits, the water nymphs that surround the grove, the yakshas of the trees, the celestial musicians, the footprints of the heroes who once trod those grasses, these are the first to go. The animate is the living flesh that is discarded in the name of something perceived to be more essential, more refined. And so the water nymphs, no pun intended, are always getting screwed. Let's talk for a minute about mindfulness and water nymphs. The Buddhist mindfulness practices of simply sitting and observing arose themselves in context. The context of a deeply regimented society with clearly delineated roles and a ritual life that involved intricate daily practices of feeding, honoring, bathing, chanting, singing. They arose within an overarching worldview that was populated by animate beings of forest and spring. The earliest of Buddhist texts, as Sam Van Schaik explores in his book Buddhist Magic, speak of such beings and the incantations to appease them. The fierce village goddesses of Orissa find their way right into the center of the Buddhist tales. In a world of such deeply constructed context, to practice simply sitting as the clouds of thought pass by made sense. There's a balance, one could say, between the contextual and the fluid, and within that balance, the mindfulness practice is ultimately inseparable from the context in which it sits. Fast forward 2,500 years to a postmodern world in which the mind is basically a jumble of disconnected and decontextualized floating rubbish. In such a world, simply sitting with what is may not be enough, because what is has been wrenched from its original context. In an age of social media addiction, frenetic discourse, talking devices, tweeting, instructing people to simply sit with what is might be akin to asking them to sit in the middle of a Category 5 hurricane of crap. It's understandable what the Buddha was doing. Focus too much on ritual, and that ritual might get empty, might become over-reliant upon external structuralism. The Buddha was responding to a society that had become extremely preoccupied with elaborate ritual. But in a modern world, in which we have no such ritual, in which minds are already untethered, jumping right to deconstruction as opposed to construction may also have its issues. Specifically, there is deep value to a mind that understands where it is in time and space, that understands the importance of the local beings of the watershed and its dependence upon those beings for survival, that is constructed like a medicine wheel along clear directional lines, that has an architecture to it that can withstand a world of media freneticism and agitated discourse, that provides a clearly articulated forest grove, as the Bhakti traditions say, that shapes the structured space in which the divine dance can then take place. Like I said, I have nothing against mindfulness practice. I think it's helped a whole lot of people. But there is also the same pattern here of essence extraction that mirrors larger patterns within the postmodern capitalist world. In the same way that we assume vitamin C is the healthy component of an orange and extract it and refine it to get to the essence, we also extract what we perceive to be the philosophical essence of spiritual traditions and get rid of all the messy stuff. Animism, ritual feeding of spirits, flames, water, flowers, chants. In short, all the embodied aspects. And then what do we find? The body can't assimilate the essence extract. The vitamin C isn't soluble. In the same way, postmodern consciousness may not be able to assimilate the benefits of simply sitting and observing its own mess for hours and hours on end without first setting that mind in embodied context. This is where the recognition of basic material alchemy is deeply helpful. This is why mythologist Martin Shaw, when recently asked about what to do to help with grief, told one listener to find a large body of water. To sit by the sea. To feel the alchemy of sea spray against skin. To return salt water to its source through tears. To let the waves wash over us. This is context. The marathon monks of Mount Hiei in Japan do several hours of calisthenics before sitting down to meditate. This takes them into the state of rapturous focus before they even arrive at the meditation cushion. In the early yogic texts, there's a reason that seated meditation is built upon a foundation of cleansing, diet, daily ritual, focused breathing, before the practice of just sitting is done. Minds need context. Everything in nature, in its intricate architecture, exists in context. The mind is no exception. This world of natural forces is not secondary to a hidden essence. Essence and its expression, as the Yoga Vashista says, is as inseparable as white from milk, heat from flame, shine from gold, as wheat is, one could say, from bread. Back to bread. So, yeah, when nutritional scientists suddenly discovered that the new refined bread they'd created had absolutely no nutrition in it because it had been stripped of all its contextual goodness, what did they do? They injected it with a bunch of additives to try and make it nutritious again. I was listening to Chapo Trap House podcast the other day and I was reminded of this because they were talking about how some agencies and consulting firms are now helping corporations bring ritual and sacredness into the workplace. You know, and this isn't a joke, hire us and we'll help you help your employees deepen their Zoom practice. We'll create corporate rituals for key moments in the life of your company. We'll create a ritual for when a company gains its LLC status or for when they embark on a new sales campaign. This, of course, is the exact equivalent of trying to re-inject nutrition into Wonder Bread. From the New York Times, quote, "We've seen brands enter the political space," said Casper Turkel, a co-founder of Sacred Design Lab. "The next white space in advertising and brands is spirituality." Rituals are a way to make a value-driven culture, says the Ritual Design Lab website, as they pitch companies on the monetary benefits of having their employees participate in ritual. So here's the postmodern context of relentless monetization on full display. The sacred shall be systematically sucked out of the overarching context of modern life through the process of monetization, and now stand back as we try to re-inject sacredness into an inherently de-sanctified system and make a few bucks in the process. From the New York Times, Sacred Design Lab trio talk about religion as a technology for delivering meaning. The question we ask is, how do you translate the ancient traditions that have given people access to meaning-making practices, but in a context that is not centered around the congregation? Right. How do you make the company, the corporation, the monetized, how do you make that the water in which we swim, in which all good things transpire, including the sacred? Needless to say, the guys at the Chapo Trap House podcast didn't mince their words when it came to this. Will Meneker said, quote, "Yeah, how do we make the technology of religious meaning making into an office? How do we transform a community of belief and faith into a community of tenuous employment? Yeah, we want all the meaning associated with deep reciprocal social bonds without any of the deep reciprocal social bonds. If you could amplify that, we'd really love it. It would really help with our earnings in the fourth quarter this year. And Matt Chrisman said, quote, "A real consequence of capitalism is that you squeeze the sacredness of life as people lose the social dimension that gives meaning to their day-to-day existence and replace it with transactions between strangers and alienating encounters with employers and employees. There has to be an answer to that, and the seeking for that answer is one of the things that leads people towards the realization that the way we live needs to change. The way we live needs to change." So yeah, what needs to be addressed is the culture of relentless monetization itself. Not peppering the white bread of the modern corporation with rituals to reclaim meaning the same way that bread that is not bread can be re-injected with nutrients that are ultimately indigestible. This means reevaluating the entire structure of work, of offices. All the assumptions about a society whose ultimate purpose, the context upon which it is based, is decontextualization for the sake of monetization. This is what needs to be deeply revisited. Context for transformation, personal, spiritual, global, yogic, need to be constructed free of this cycle. The cycle that results in bread that is not bread, shamanism that is not shamanism, ritual that is not ritual, mindfulness that is not mindfulness, context that is decontextualized. What would spirituality look like these days free of this cycle? What would the yoga world look like? A lot less Instagram posts maybe, and a lot more singing together beneath the banyan trees? When do we get tired of this relentless cycle? When do we say, "I'm learning knitting just to knit, and not because I have to start my own Etsy page and conquer the world"? When do we stop thinking about how our life experience translates into us becoming our own brand? This is the modern-day rape of the Grail Maidens. It ensures that the sacred fount of eternal water remains hidden further and further away, because it decontextualizes minds before they even have a chance to grow and develop within sacred context. So yeah, I'm not interested in perpetuating an absolutism of strict definitions on what is what, or policing the yoga world or the mindfulness world, which sounds like a pretty thankless task. What I'm interested in is starting to open a conversation on context. What would it look like to have a life practice whose primary purpose was the seamless integration of consciousness, community, and cosmos in context? What would it look like to commit to a mythic repopulating of the modern mind slowly over time, in which the end goal was not a product but a rekindling of our deep connection with what is? There may come a time, Aragorn says to Eowyn in The Two Towers, for valor without renown, right? For our actions just to be for the sake of our actions themselves. There may be a time when no one is watching. There may be a time when we're not able to post about it afterwards. When we leave this world, we leave it alone. We leave it naked before the universe. At that point, who are we? What is the context in which we've structured our lives, our hearts, our minds? Luckily, understandings of context are on the rise. The return to deep work, to programs of long-term study, to craft, to knowledge for the sake of knowledge, to community for the sake of community, is happening. Science, a huge part of the reason for our decontextualized view of the cosmos to begin with, is now suddenly recognizing the value of context when it comes to studying how whole natural systems work. Hopefully this all continues. Keep it up, and scientists may just discover why the traditional songs are so important to the rituals, that none of this creation is fully expressed unless it is expressed within a context of story and song. Keep it up, and we might collectively remember where the North Star is, or which way is east, or the phase of the moon. We might remember the value of dancing for dancing's sake. Remember when we dance just for the sake of dancing? Felt the wet dew upon the skin? Moved within a great prism of context. ¶¶ This episode contains reference to some books and articles and such, and these are The Tables Turned, a poem by William Wordsworth, NPR's piece on October 1st, 2020, For Subway, a Ruling Not So Sweet, Irish Court Says Its Bread Isn't Bread, How to Change Your Mind, and In Defense of Food, both by Michael Pollan, Sand Talk by Tyson Yonkaporta, Buddhist Magic by Sam Van Schaik, The Mantana Bhairava Tantram, translated and commented upon by Mark Diskowski, The Yoga Vashista by Swami Venkateshananda, The Two Towers by J.R.R. Tolkien, Chapo Trap House podcast, the November Rain episode, which aired on September 14th, 2020, The Hindu Tantric World by Andre Padu, God is Dead, So is the Office, These People Want to Save Both by Nellie Bowles, writing in the New York Times on August 28th, 2020, Meet Viridia, the Atai Unit Exploring Ayahuasca-Based Treatments for Mental Illness by Amira Al-Idris, fiercebiotech.com on July 22, 2020. And of course, the South Florida Sun Sentinel article from April 29, 2013, Florida Man on Acid Asked to Have His Penis Cut Off. If you liked what you heard today, please consider becoming a patron. You can find out more at patreon.com/TheEmeraldPodcast. That's Patreon, patreon.com/TheEmeraldPodcast. There are patronage levels starting for as low as $6 per month, and patrons get a variety of benefits that are listed on the site. I hope you enjoy today's episode, and until next time, may we live lives that are driven forth by imagination, vision, and wonder.